I'm speaking so easy, you have no idea.
Everybody, please give a warm welcome to David Weinberg, our speakeasy guest. So, David, first of all, just introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us what you do for your official employment, and you know how that's going, how you're doing.
Okay. Yeah. My name is David Weinberg. I work for Marketplace as a staff reporter. I have Eve's old job.
Do you have my old desk? Do you sit at my desk?
I have the desk next to.
Oh, okay.
Desk, yeah, Bob Boone's old desk. But I actually do owe like all my big breaks in radio to Eve. She starts a thing and then I get to work on it and then she leaves and I get to like.
I wonder
the
what
ladder.
The next thing will be.
But yes, but I so I got my start here in New Orleans more or less. That's where my first radio stories ever got played.
What were the things that when you landed in New Orleans you found that you really wanted to tell?
Oh man, I had no idea what I was doing when I got here.
2000 what year?
This was 2006.
Yep, that sounds right.
Somewhere there. I guess I'll explain how I got into radio, which was in sort of a roundabout way. I had dropped out of college and was working during the day as a janitor at the university that my friends were going to. And at night I was delivering pizzas. And I was happy for a while, but then I just got really unhappy when I realized, like, oh, shit, like, what am I going to do with my life? I don't like being a janitor. And then I heard this story on the radio called The Test by Scott Carrier, which I don't know. Have any of you guys ever heard his work before? Scott Carrier before? But it just changed me. It just like had this sort of awakening, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. How do I figure this thing out? And I went to the library, and he had a book there. It was like a collection of his stories from the radio and print, and I sat down and I read the whole book in one sitting at the library, and I was like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. But I didn't know how to do that, and I didn't have the sense to like show up at a public radio station and be like, is there some way I can help here? Like what? And well, the thing is that the mythology around Scott Carrier is the way that he got into radio was that he hitchhiked to Washington, D.C., and recorded all the people that picked him up on the way, and he showed up at NPR headquarters with all these tapes that he'd made while hitchhiking there and said, I want to put these on the radio. And they did. They put them on the radio. They had, like, I think it was Scott Simon. Like, let him sleep on his couch, and they helped him, which maybe gives you a sense of how different things were. This was at the very beginning of NPR. And so in my head, I was like, oh, well, that's how you do it. You know, you hitchhike around, and you gather tape. And so I spent years just...
A dude. By the way, no girl would ever do this. Go ahead.
So I spent years hitchhiking around, gathering tape. I went to Alaska, worked up there for a while, and kind of bummed around, and went down to Mexico, and lived in Seattle for a year, and then I was living in my van when I showed up here in New Orleans.
How many great musician interviews have started that way? Not so many public radio reporters.
No. But there, I saw the sign for OZ. I was just biking around, and I saw the sign. I was like, oh, hey, a radio station. I should go in there and like tell them I have all these recordings, and... At the time, Fred Goodrich was the program director. He's awesome, but he's crazy. And he was just talking a mile a minute. He's like, yeah, bring us a story, you know? And so I was like, okay. And then I just went out and did a story and brought it back, and they liked it, and they put it on the radio. And then I did like 40 of those. I did, did like a couple a month for the whole time I lived here.
But what do you think about a particular story attracts you to it? Like, what is your sensibility when it comes to that?
I mean, I always look for characters. That's usually the first thing that I look for, is like a compelling character. That's like my first instinct, you know. Some stories will come out of like the project, you know, part of a story. But, you know, I like traditional narratives. I like there to be some sort of arc. I like, you know, good versus evil is always fun, or like solving, how do we solve this problem, or like looking for the thing that creates the tension, and ideally there's a compelling central character that you can build something around.
So who are some of those characters you found in New Orleans in the late 2000s, shall we say?
The first story I did for OZ was about Peter Spring, who he had come down here from Oregon after Katrina with a truckload of pianos and just started giving them out to musicians. And then he stayed, and he had this nonprofit where he would gather up pianos, fix them up, and give them musicians. And so I had put an ad on Craigslist saying, like, basically looking for a place to store my recording equipment. And he answered the ad and said, I have this warehouse. You can store your equipment here. You can live here if you want. I need help moving pianos. So that was my first story. It was about Peter. And in the first story I ever did that aired on NPR was actually about JT Nesbitt, who is here tonight.
JT?
Somewhere. Hello. We'll talk about him later. But JT was an interesting guy. He was at the time, he was building a car. He was taking a car that had been destroyed by Katrina and trying to get it to break a world land speed record at the Bonneville Salt Flats as sort of his revenge against Katrina. And so he was also a bartender at Flanagan's, where my friend worked, and my friend was like, hey, my buddy's screening his documentary at the One Eyed Jacks, let's go see it. And so that was one of those moments where you see this film on screen and you're like, oh, this guy's amazing and he lives down the street, I should go talk to him, because I could probably make a good story out of it.
I think one of the things that sets David apart is a fearlessness about story and about character, and just saying, this is an amazing person, this is an amazing story. It doesn't have to necessarily be tied to the news, or it doesn't have to be structured in a way. I don't have to know the whole thing before I go into it. Like, it's just a sort of a gut instinct that you go on when you meet someone, they start talking, and as you just said to me, they start to spit gold.
Yeah.
So what do you do at that point? I mean, you don't always have your recording gear on you. Do you sort of develop a relationship? I mean, your interviewing style, is it formal? Where do you take things? You meet someone like JT, and then what happens?
I feel like there's a nice thing about being really green where you don't know what not to do. And so, I mean, there would be times when I would be talking with someone and they'd be like, oh, I just met this guy, he's really interesting. And then I would just bike over to his house with my gear and be like, yeah, can I interview you, you know? And so sometimes it was that, you know? But yeah, there are lots of times, I feel like more often now, where I come across really interesting stuff that doesn't fit into my job at Marketplace, and then you just have to figure out where it can go.
Right, you know? Right. So I think we've established you have a commitment to character, you have a commitment to kind of the extreme, you know, not, you're more interested in people who are doing something out there, not necessarily in describing or reporting on like the everyday run-of-the-mill experience, that type of thing. You're not trying to find the romance in like regular life. You like the stuff at the edges.
Yeah, it's just a lot easier.
Well, yeah, it sticks out, right? I mean, yeah, squeaky wheel gets the grease, I guess. So how then do you go from that, though, to pitching a story to a national show? Okay, you've got these interesting people, these kooky characters, you've got all this great tape, you know. These are not the Scott Carrier days. You can't show up at NPR in D.C. and be lucky enough to find Alex Chadwick there on a Sunday and he'll actually listen to your weird cassette tapes. Like, how do you go from having some interesting tape and interesting people to writing a pitch to a national show and getting them to run it? And then what's that experience like of like putting your aesthetic and your passion for sound and interview and character through the ringer of an editor who says, well, we got to turn this into news. We got to turn this gold here into news.
Right. The first thing is you have to figure out, like, so every editor of every show and every news, you know, organization, they have their sort of boxes that they have, like, this, how are we going to fit this into our box? Like, this is what we do. And a lot of times the stuff I have is just not going to fit in that box. And so it's a matter of, can I find a way to carve out some piece of like this story and attach it to something that will make sense? Like, sometimes it's a matter of doing that. But we're kind of in a golden age right now where you don't have to just get your stuff out through big news organizations. Like, how I made my living as a freelancer was I would do a story for the local station, but then I would sell it three more times. So I would sell it to Marketplace and do that version of it, and then I would sell it to 99% Invisible or some other podcast that had a budget. And there's a ton of these new shows popping up now that have budgets to pay freelancers. So,
is that what we have tape
of?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So this is a story. Tell us a little bit about this story first. You sold it to a few different places, or you had it tape them and appear in a few places?
So I got an assignment. I pitched this, actually. I thought this was an interesting story. There's a down in Skid Row in Los Angeles, there's this new experimental building going up to house homeless people, and it's experimental in a couple different ways. It's architecturally experimental. It's a building that's built out of sort of these modules that they assemble together. But then they're also pre-selecting all the people that get to live in this building. They're pre-selecting based on how much they cost our economy. So if you cost us a ton of money as a homeless person, if you go to the emergency room a lot, if you go to jail a lot, then you are a priority to stay in this building, which goes against a lot of the current models, which is like, first you got to get your act together. And then you can, then we'll give you housing. But this is a housing first model. And so they end up picking these people that have, I mean, by
highly
the nature
dysfunctional,
of them, are not trying in a lot of ways to fix their situation. So I thought that was an interesting story. So I was just down in Skid Row interviewing people, and then this happened.
What, can you just, for someone that, can you set the scene for me? Like, for someone that never been
the
here before?
The scene?
Where we explain it, and then what we're looking at, and where we are.
Can you guys hear it?
We're on the corner. No, that's too much information for your radio station. Way too much.
I'm gonna tell them. They're gonna know where we are. Like, that's a given. I'm just asking you to say it.
No, I'm not gonna say it.
Okay, well, we're at King Eddie's. What does it look like? Just say what you're looking at.
Disney's off the hook. There are people standing out in front. If you go inside, there's going to be a bouncer. You know what I'm saying? He regulates pretty good. Then there are going to be some people at the bar. You're going to see a couple cute white girls. You're going to see a couple cute black girls. You're going to see a couple cute Hispanic girls. And you're going to, you know what I'm saying? You're going to get your swag on. You walk up in there, and they automatically go, you know what I'm saying? You're going to, all eyes are on you because you got that 100% swag going anyway, right? You sit down, you know. You order a drink, right? You order the lady next to you a drink. You know what I'm saying? You know, you have a discussion. You take her out on the dance floor and you dance with her when nobody else is dancing in the whole bar, right? And you make her feel like a lady for a little while, and she doesn't even have to be that attractive. And then they're all gonna start like, wow, you know, this guy is just like, you know, what is with this guy, you know? And they're gonna wanna have that vibe. And they're gonna gather around and they're gonna start, you know, there's a science to it too. There's everything that you can imagine up here. Everything that you want, you know. You want a girl, you know what I'm saying? You want whatever you want. You want some bud, whatever you want, it's up in there. But it's, you know, it's just like any other place down here on Skid Row. That's what this place consists of. It's disease and drugs and alcohol and poverty. Yeah. An outside giant insane asylum. That's what it is. The devil's den. That's where you're at. Yeah. You got a lot of balls.
You got a lot of balls. All right.
So I came back with that tape, and it's like, that's not going to go on Marketplace, you know? But it's so good.
You know, you got all kinds of things you want in there.
Yeah,
you got two cute white girls. You got two. No.
I mean, my assignment was to do a 3.5-minute feature. I think that cut of tape is like over 2 minutes. So what I did was is I ended up using what I could in the Marketplace piece. I tried to make him into a character. I pulled the, I think I maybe got 20 seconds of Little Daddy in that piece. But then what I ended up doing is what you just heard is actually the beginning of a 30-minute piece that's going to come out in a few days. It's a co-production that I produced with a couple new shows. One of them is called The Organist, which is a partnership between the McSweeney's magazine, The Believer, and KCRW, and the other one is For Love and Radio. And so I put together this half, and the piece was actually about, it's about Clyde Casey, who's also here tonight.
Hi, Casey.
But that's the beauty of sort of the time we're in now, is like there's all these other shows out there that you can. So it worked out. You know, I got to use a little bit of Little Daddy for Marketplace, and then I got to do what I wanted to do for these other outlets. So.
Right. I think I heard in the Writer's Almanac recently someone who said that they use their novels to fund their poetry, which
right.
is in a way what you're doing. You know, you're using your work on Marketplace to take some of these other formats and make something from it. So just real quick, give people a typical day at Marketplace. How does the day go for you?
So it's basically my days. I have two types of days. I'm either on spot duty, which is my daily assignments. So usually 2 or 3 days a week, I have a daily assignment. So I get up early in the morning, and then I read the news, and I send my pitches to the editors. Like, this is what I think we should cover today. This is topical. This is what's happening today. And then when I get in at about 8:30, I'll get my assignment from my editor, and I have about 4 hours to put the story together. And so that means I'm at my desk, and then I'm calling sources and doing my interviews over the phone from my desk, recording those interviews, and then pulling the clips from those interviews in the editing software, and then writing my script around that. So I have about 8:30 to 12:30 to do that part of the job. And so then when I finish my script, I go into the office with my editor, and I perform the story live for him, basically. So I read the script, and then when the tape cuts come up, I hit play on the computer, and then we edit it right there. And it's usually like a 10 or 15 minute edit. Like, he'll be like, oh, change this, da-da-da-da. Then I'll read it through, and then I'll be like, good, go. And then I'll run into the studio. And
literally I'll run, usually.
Yeah, because the show goes at 2. And then I'll run into the studio, and I'll record my narration, and then the engineers will assemble my cuts that I've pulled with my narration, put it all together, and then Kai will introduce it with the host intro, and it'll go. We actually do the show live at 2 p.m. Not every station in the country picks up the live feed, but we do the show live so that the West Coast stations can run it at 2 live. So it is a lot of pressure. And the first spot I did, I finished at 1:57, and they were like, don't ever do that again.
Somehow you managed to survive.
Yeah. But
Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an intense schedule. I mean, you have 4 hours to do original reporting, get at least 2 interviews, and then, you know, if you can incorporate sound from like a TV show or a commercial or something like that, if you think about it. I feel like Daily News is sort of like writing a sonnet, in that there's this structure that you have to, there's no option. Yeah. If it's going to be called a spot on a Daily News show, it has to have certain qualities in the same way that a sonnet has to have certain qualities. Yeah. And so you have to get creative kind of around that. But I do think that like doing that on deadline is particularly interesting. And that's one of the things that makes all of this sort of listening and talking to other characters applicable to Daily News. I mean, yes, it's about being really authoritative and whatever, but it's also about being really creative in a short amount of time. So you have something else for us to listen to. Do you want to cue that up?
Sure. So this is a story I'm working on for Marketplace. So the story isn't done. What I'm playing for you is sort of like a mixture of a rough draft and a trailer for a radio story. So,
but I think it's a great example. I mean, you stay in touch with people over time, and who knows what they're going to do. You find interesting people, and they keep doing interesting things.
Yeah, I mean, I did my first story on NPR about JT 2007. So
7 years later.
I'm just going to play this for you.
JT Nesbitt was at the height of his career when he lost everything. In 2005, he was one of the top motorcycle designers in the world. His picture graced the cover of magazines. Celebrities sought out his extravagantly expensive bikes. Even the Prince of Bahrain invited him to his palace. But while he was there, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and destroyed the shop where JT's bikes were built. 7 years later, JT was broke, about to take a job waiting tables, when a stranger showed up on his doorstep. Neither of them knew that out of that first meeting, a plan would emerge that would change both their lives. Now, they're on a quest to reinvent 2 American industries. Like many great New Orleans stories, this one begins in a bar in the French Quarter at a place called Molly's.
Yeah, we were at Molly's.
That's Jim Jacoby. As a lover of design, he was a big fan of JT's motorcycles. And in 2012, he happened to be in New Orleans. So he looked JT up and asked if he could buy him a beer. He was surprised to find out that JT hadn't built a motorcycle in over 7 years. So there at the bar, Jim asked JT a question. What would you do if you could do anything?
Strangely, as if it were rehearsed, he had his notebook with him and pulled it out.
I always carry my sketchbook with me, always.
That's JT. He made Jim swear on his grandmother's eyeballs that he wouldn't tell anyone what he was about to show him. Then he opened up his sketchbook to a drawing of a strange-looking motorcycle. One that JT claimed would reinvent motorcycle engineering in profound ways.
He was blown away and he said, wow, how much would it cost to build one of those? And I immediately knew the answer because this is all I've been thinking about for 8 years. And then he says, well, how much to build 3 of them? That's when I took pause and furrowed my brows, like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
At some point in this conversation, maybe 3 beers in, maybe 4, Jim decided that he wanted to help JT turn his sketches into reality.
It's unacceptable that somebody like JT would be sitting here waiting, unable to do what he's capable of doing. And if we don't capture this in people like JT, and we'll have lost something incredibly American and something incredibly valuable.
What I saw was a motorcycle that basically challenges many, many engineering precepts that go back 120 years. This is a guy who not only stepped back to square one, but then he stepped out of the square.
So that's sort of a rough draft. But JT's here, and I thought it would be really cool to have him talk about this motorcycle, because the truth is that this is not really a story about a motorcycle. The motorcycle is really just sort of a byproduct of this much bigger idea to, this is going to be hard to explain, but to try to bring humanity back into the digital world where we are increasingly spending more of our lives in. So what you'll find out later in the story is that Jim Jacoby is actually he's a tech guy. He made a good bit of money starting a tech company called Manifest Digital that built websites and did social marketing for like really big companies like McDonald's and stuff like that. And he had a sort of epiphany where he realized that he hated his job and he didn't think that what he was doing was serving humanity in an important way. And so, you know, he came across JT at a time when he was looking for a way to try to train engineers, software engineers and web developers, to look at their job the way that a master craftsman would, because Because if you do work and you don't sort of love it and you don't appreciate the value of the work itself, then the product that you make is going to be inferior. And because the product that these people are making is an infrastructure in which we live in. I mean, we live in the digital world. Our human interactions are mediated by technology. And so if the technology is not built with a humanist eye, then we, in a sense, become less human. And so this is a really big problem. And his idea to solve this problem is to study the way that this motorcycle is being built. And I want JT to come up and maybe just help us explain. So do you want to come up and bring your sketchbook? And
just for a second.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, JT Nesbitt.
I'd like to start with a pretty important statement, and that is that what I do is more important than who I am. And I think that ties into the problem with the digital world, is that celebrity is prioritized over the work. So it's more important who you are than it is what you do. I am what I do. That's what comes first. And if I'm teaching the digital people a lesson, I think that would be it. But the interesting thing is that in the world that we live in today, I think that innovation comes from without. It doesn't start inside an industry. And isn't it interesting that so many people want to cling to the 20th century so desperately, when the one lesson that the digital world is teaching us is that the 21st century, things are different now. They're not the same. And motorcycles is an interesting place to start, because talk about a degenerative industry. I mean, there hasn't been anything new, or even new ideas. New ideas get frowned upon. People aren't interested in that sort of thing. They're interested in reliving 20th century iconic experiences.
Like the Harley Davidson.
I wasn't going to name names, but if you insist.
Yeah.
So what I've been able to do is step back and for the past 8 years think about one thing and sketch one thing, which is and center in one question: what should an American motorcycle be? Thank you.
So I think, though, that demonstrated a pretty good principle, which is that, yeah, he just said, you asked me to bring my sketchbook for radio. But yeah, that's what you do. Yeah. If you're going to be visiting somebody and talking about their family, you look at the family pictures. You want to talk to somebody about their correspondence. You have them bring the letters, you know, something to give you some grist. And, like, once you find out about it, following up and getting at the things that actually show the story, you know. I think what we're going to do at this point is maybe open it up to questions. If anyone has any questions, comments, concerns for David.
I'd love to hear your concerns.
Yeah, especially your concerns.
Can you tell us why Marketplace is in Los Angeles rather than New York?
Okay. Marketplace is in Los Angeles out of an idea that it's best to cover the business world by not being in its epicenter. Also because I think the founder, Jim Russell, happened to live in Los Angeles at the time. And Marketplace has this affiliation with USC, the University of Southern California, which is kind of an affiliation in name only. It actually used to be produced on campus in this rickety old building that I believe was housing for students who were there on the GI Bill and who were married and had families. It was kind of this weird white clapboard building off in the corner of USC. And Marketplace has been in LA for, I don't know, almost 30 years now. But it is increasingly New York-centric. I mean, I would say the stories that make it on the top of the show are usually Washington and New York.
Yeah, and we have bureaus there. We have a New York bureau and a DC bureau.
So it's a bit of an anomaly.
The financial world is such a perceived cutthroat world. How does the financial world perceive Marketplace relative to the MSNBCs and the louder universe?
I don't know. I think because we inhabit the public radio world, we are really a segment within public radio, and I feel like that somehow sets us apart more than being compared to other business news shows in a way. And because there's not really, I mean, other than like Planet Money and Freakonomics, there's not really any other radio shows that do what we do. So I feel like we're able to sort of avoid those comparisons because we're radio.
A lot of times people would confuse Marketplace with Market Watch, which is a CBS yeah. thing. And so there's a lot of confusion. I mean, some people, when you call and say you're from Marketplace, I mean, I always say, I'm calling from Marketplace. We're at, and some people are like, oh my God, I love Marketplace. And yeah. sometimes people have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah. And you really don't know unless it's someone you've talked to before.
Yeah.
One risk that Marketplace does run in getting to know the financial industry more, and probably since the financial crisis, is getting a little too insider-y. So kind of the point, we hope, is... I don't work there anymore. But so I think Marketplace occupies this space where they try to be the outsider insider. Like, we understand, but we're not in bed with you guys, which, if you've listened to the magnum opus, Giant Pool of Money, is what a lot of people presume to have been part of the problem in the financial collapse of 2008, was just like the press being so complicit with just going along with whatever they heard from analysts and not saying, wait a minute, what? I mean, I think it can be a very intimidating world in the sense that someone says, well, the such and such happened because investors are feeling such and such. And you're like, oh, yeah. And then you just repeat that. It means absolutely nothing. Yeah. Investors don't feel anything. Most trading is done by algorithms now. So anytime someone says investors feel something, it doesn't mean anything.
I saw a tweet that was like... Something, investors shivered.
Or
it was like an actual news business show.
Consumers are feeling, it's yeah. like people. People are consumers. There's no, like, it's not an alien race of consumers, you know? It's just like humans. If you are a human, you are a consumer. First of all, let's give a big round of applause for David for coming out. Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
David, any parting words?
Nope. Thanks. Thank
Famous
you. Thank
words.
You for having me in New Orleans.
Enjoy your night, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.